From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ghost Wars, the secret history of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Osama bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Kahl about his new book. He's the managing editor of The Washington Post and the former South Asian bureau chief. Also, Sofia Coppola, she wrote and directed Lost in Translation. It's up for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon has sent 50 Marines to Haiti to help protect the U.S. Embassy and its staff. The decision to send the troops came after opponents of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide seized control of the nation's second-largest city and threatened to move on to the capital. NPR's Martin Costi is in Port-au-Prince.
There's been no direct threat to the embassy or U.S. personnel here that we know of. Even though this is called an anti-terrorism team that's being sent here, I think the real concern is the general instability, the fact that there are concerns that the armed groups that have acted in northern Haiti could show up here in the capital. There's been no direct sign of that, but they've certainly threatened to do so. So I think this is more a desire for some kind of security in the event that there's some kind of violent confrontation here between these armed groups and the government.
NPR's Martin Costi in Port-au-Prince. Education Secretary Rod Paige said today that the nation's largest teachers union, the National Education Association, was a terrorist organization. NPR's Don Gagne says Paige made the remark at a private meeting with Republican and Democratic governors at the White House.
Many of the governors present later confirmed the remark and were critical. That prompted not an apology, but a clarification statement. From Page, he said it was an inappropriate choice of words to describe the obstructionist scare tactics the NEA's Washington lobbyists have employed against the No Child Left Behind reforms. So still on the attack, but at least acknowledging that he shouldn't have called them a terrorist organization. He also said it was just a bad joke.
NPR's Don Gagne at the White House. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said today that it could be possible to hold national elections in Iraq by the end of this year, but only if the country sets up an independent election commission right away. Annan issued a report today that was prepared by a UN team that visited Iraq. NPR's Ivan Watson says the UN report effectively ends the U.S. plan to create a provisional Iraqi government through regional caucuses.
The UN said that this plan does not enjoy any support from Iraqis. It's not a viable option. But it said that the call for elections that have been coming from the largest religious group in the country, Shia Muslims, that cannot be organized before 8 months go by, and that can only happen if all of Iraq's different competing religious and ethnic groups agree on a legal framework to lead to this.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. Annan didn't make any recommendations on how an Iraqi caretaker government should be set up for when the U.S. hands over sovereignty on June 30th. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 9 points to close at 10,609 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 30 points to close at 2007. This is NPR News. Composer Bart Howard has died. He was best known for writing the tune Fly Me to the Moon. Howard died on Saturday from a stroke in Carmel, New York. He was 88 years old. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Back in 1954, composer Bart Howard dashed off this tune in 20 minutes. He called it In Other Words. Singer Peggy Lee suggested another title, and after dozens of recordings, Fly Me to the Moon became a standard.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars.
Bart Howard grew up in Iowa and played in an army band in World War II. He moved to New York at age 23 and met Cole Porter. His idol had some advice: you'll never find success until you sing your own songs. But Howard was successful as a composer. It wasn't until he turned 73 years old that he sang his work in public for the first time. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Ralph Nader's decision to run for president is drawing different reactions from the Democratic presidential hopefuls. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean urged supporters not to be tempted to vote for Nader, saying that a vote for the consumer activist would draw support from the eventual Democratic nominee and improve President Bush's chances for re-election. Senator John Edwards, meanwhile, courted voters who supported Nader 4 years ago, saying that he's equally strong on consumer issues. Edwards is also hoping for support from voters who backed Dean until his withdrawal from the race last week. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 3 points to close at 1141. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sundance Channel, presenting Tanner 88, an original series from creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau. New episodes every Tuesday at 9 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The CIA's attempt to stop Osama bin Laden before September 11th and its failure to succeed is one of the main issues Steve Call investigates in his new book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10, 2001. Call is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was the Washington Post's South Asia bureau chief between 1989 and 92. He's now the Post's managing editor. In Ghost Wars, Call writes that the CIA's central place in this story is unusual compared to its role in other cataclysmic episodes in American history. The attacks of September 11th were conceived by a terrorist network that had developed in Afghanistan at the end of the Cold War when the Afghan Islamists, the Mujahideen, fought the Soviet invasion. The CIA backed the Mujahideen, as did the Pakistani and Saudi intelligence agencies. I asked Call if, after the Cold War, the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence agencies continued to back the Islamic militants after they had become our enemy. He told me the nature of our alliance with the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence agencies changed over time.
It was most intimate during the 1980s, where we did forge a very close and richly funded alliance among ourselves, carried out through the CIA, Pakistan, prosecuted mainly through their military intelligence agency, ISI, and Saudi Arabia, which has an intelligence department which isn't as large as either ours or Pakistan's, but is, in the manner of things in Saudi Arabia, very richly funded. And the three of us collaborated in a series of secret programs designed successfully, ultimately, to expel Soviet forces from Afghanistan and to aid the Mujahideen. After the Soviet troops withdrew, our alliances with Saudi and Pakistani intelligence continued, but they became much more complicated and increasingly poisoned. As our interests in the region waned, and actually their interests increased, and they began to fund, continued to fund, and to expand the reach of Islamist groups based in Afghanistan that increasingly had an anti-American agenda as well as a regional agenda.
Now, you have gotten information that bin Laden worked for a while as a Saudi intelligence operative. What have you learned about that?
While I was researching this book, I traveled to Saudi Arabia and I met two interesting characters, Ahmed Badib and Saeed Badib. Ahmed Badib was the chief of staff to Saudi intelligence from the early 1980s until 1997. He was the primary operator for Prince Turki al-Faisal, who was the longtime chief of Saudi intelligence. And Ahmed Badib was a teacher of Osama bin Laden in southwestern Saudi Arabia at the time that bin Laden was coming of age at Saudi universities. And when bin Laden went to Afghanistan to wage jihad against the Soviet occupying forces, Badib maintained a professional relationship with him of some sort. And Badib describes a relationship with bin Laden that was really quite operational in the sense that bin Laden seems to have carried out contracts let by the Saudi intelligence agency to support Saudi factions in the Afghan war. I don't have any reason to believe that bin Laden was a paid agent in the sense that we all remember from spy stories being paid a retainer, because bin Laden was so wealthy that he wouldn't have required such a stipend. But he clearly had an official or a semi official relationship with Saudi intelligence during those years.
So he was working with Saudi intelligence during the years that the Soviets were occupying Afghanistan and the Afghans were fighting against the Soviets.
That's right. Saudi intelligence collaborated with the CIA during those years in a financial agreement in which the Saudis agreed to match whatever funds Congress appropriated secretly to support the Afghan Mujahideen. And those funds swelled as the 80s progressed. They began on the order of magnitude of $50 or $100 million annually. By the late 1980s, Congress was allocating northwards of $500 million annually to support the Mujahideen. And every time Congress passed one of these secret appropriations, the CIA met with Prince Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi intelligence agency wrote a check for the same amount. Now, in addition to that part of the program, the Saudi intelligence service ran its own what are called unilateral operations secretly on its own outside of CIA eyesight on the Afghan frontier. And it was here that bin Laden, I think, played a significant role. He was the son of Saudi Arabia's most important construction scion, a man who had literally built modern Mecca and Medina, the two most important cities in the Islamic world. And he had grown up riding bulldozers in his father's firms. He knew how to make roads. He knew how to make buildings and storage facilities. And so as he collaborated with Saudi intelligence in the border areas between Pakistan and Afghanistan, he was seemingly, by Badib's account, commissioned to build roads and depots and storage and medical facilities for Mujahideen groups that were particularly favored by Saudi intelligence.
After the Cold War, did the Saudis still support bin Laden? I mean, it was in the early 90s that bin Laden leaves Saudi Arabia and splits with Saudi Arabia because the Saudis are in alliance with the United States during the first Gulf War in 91. So even though bin Laden leaves Saudi Arabia, is angry at the Saudi family, are they still working with him?
Well, it's a very important question, and the record is fragmentary in some respects, but I think it's possible to address the issues in at least a confident outline form. We know that the relationship between bin Laden and the royal family changed significantly between about 1989 and roughly 1993, 1994. Now, how this happened over the course of 5 years is a complicated story, but in summary, bin Laden, having expelled or participated in the expulsion of Soviet forces from Afghanistan, began to think with other self-described Islamist theologians about who was the new enemy, and increasingly he focused on the Saudi royal family and its acceptance of American troops in the kingdom as part of defense agreements born in the first Gulf War. And as he became angrier, as bin Laden became angrier and angrier at the royal family initially sought, as it often does with domestic opponents, to appease him and to sort of buy him off through cooperative meetings and dialogue. And there was not a lot of appetite in the royal family to confront him initially. They finally broke over domestic issues in Saudi Arabia when bin Laden began to speak openly in the kingdom against the royal family and to denounce the royal family as illegitimate in religious terms. And after a series of confrontational meetings with members of the royal family, bin Laden was finally expelled from the kingdom in the summer of 1992. And as he was expelled, he sort of shook his fist, metaphorically speaking, in anger at the kingdom and vowed to wage jihad against the royal family for the rest of his years, and that's something that he is still doing.
When did American intelligence first become aware of the threat of bin Laden and al-Qaeda?
They first became aware of bin Laden at all in the late 1980s. At that time, he was just another name on the frontier in the war against Soviet occupying forces. He wasn't seen as a threat in those years at all, but he was noted. And many of the Afghans, moderate Afghans, royalist Afghans, who were part of the resistance, did describe him as a threat as someone who was too radical for Afghan national traditions and ought to be watched warily. About 1989-1990, the CIA began to pick up its first reports from its own paid agents about bin Laden's political activities in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And here they began to learn that bin Laden was collaborating with and perhaps funding a radical regional agenda. Now, during these years, the CIA did not rate bin Laden as a threat to the United States, but they began to take note of his radical, even transnational agenda. It's really not until 1997-1998 that the CIA fully recognizes bin Laden as a direct threat to the United States. In the intervening years, while bin Laden was in exile in Sudan, the CIA did track him quite closely and began to describe him as a rising threat in the Middle East. They saw bin Laden funding radical groups in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and other places. They saw him running guns. In 1996, a close aide to bin Laden walked out and defected. The CIA and the FBI debriefed him, and they really learned quite a lot about how extensive bin Laden's ambitions really were. That alarmed them. And so gradually they became much more aware of him as a potential threat to the United States. And by 1997-98, I think he's fully recognized as a direct threat to the United States.
And he's fully recognized as a direct threat after the embassy bombings?
Even before, he began to declare in his published writings, his self-styled fatwas, and in media interviews, that it was time to turn his attention, al-Qaeda's attention, toward the United States directly. There were a whole series of arcane but in retrospect, important theological debates underway within the broader movement that bin Laden claimed to lead about essentially who is the enemy. And there were many opinions about that. Saudi Arabia was seen by some, including bin Laden, as an important enemy. Others wanted to concentrate on the Egyptian government, which was seen as apostate and secular and a lackey of the United States. And still others eventually decided that, well, only the United States itself was the right enemy at this hour, that it was necessary to reach all the way to the United States and to shake its role in the world. And so I think you refer to the Africa embassy bombings in the summer of 98. That's certainly an important turning point, because then he emerges into plain sight as someone who has both the intent and now the demonstrated means to kill American officials and civilians.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Call, and he's managing editor of The Washington Post and author of the new book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about your book. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Steve Call, author of the new book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. When we left off, we were talking about the African embassy bombings of 1998, which Bin Laden was behind. Was it only after the embassy bombings that the United States started planning ways to capture or assassinate him?
No, in fact, they began to plan ways to capture or kill him prior to the embassy bombings. Though the plans were developed by working-level CIA officers, they were never approved for full implementation. It's fascinating in retrospect, because just 6 to 8 months before the embassy bombings, as best I can reconstruct the timeline, the CIA, working from its counterterrorist center, which is located at headquarters in Langley, Virginia, but also from its station in Islamabad, Pakistan, which was the nearest station it operated to Afghanistan during these years, the CIA developed a plan working through a group of paid agents, Afghan agents, who intended to attack bin Laden's farm where he lived outside the Afghan city of Kandahar. And they intended to sort of sneak into the farm at night, in the middle of the night, and pull bin Laden out of his bed and kidnap him and take him to a cave which they had already identified in southeastern Afghanistan, and which, with, it's entertaining to think, American taxpayer dollars, they had provisioned the cave with water and food so that they could keep bin Laden there for about 30 days in the hope that things would calm down and that they could find a government, perhaps the United States, that would be willing to take him for trial. So this plan was very fully developed in a sort of bureaucratic sense. There was lots of cables, there were lots of meetings, there were satellite photography taken, there were maps made, and this plan was briefed to the Clinton White House in the spring of 1998, again, just a few months before the Africa embassy bombings. But as it was reviewed in its final form, both the chain of command, senior chain of command at the CIA, from Director George Tenet down through the Directorate of Operations immediately below him, and the chain of command at the White House, decided that the plan was unsound, that it wouldn't work. And so they told the officers who had developed it that it had to be shelved.
Why was that plan shelved? Was it considered to be an unworkable plan, too expensive a plan that would be embarrassing if it was released?
Different people will tell you different things about that. Not too expensive. Unworkable is a word you hear from some of the people who were involved in reviewing it. There was a fear that as a tactical plan, it had too many risks and not enough chances for success. The attacking party, which was about 30 Afghan paid agents, these were veterans of the Afghan war, people with some military experience, but they were a pretty rough group. And they were meant to approach this walled compound across a flat open plain in the middle of the night and to infiltrate it under a wall and to correctly identify the house that bin Laden was sleeping in, because one of his wives lived there, and to be able to find bin Laden in that house and attack or kill his bodyguards while they got bin Laden into a jeep and drove away. And there were a couple of concerns about it. One was, this is just not going to work. These guys are going to get slaughtered on their way to the wall, or they're going to get killed in a firefight inside, and then bin Laden's going to reap a huge global publicity coup. Another concern was, even if it works, he's going to leave a lot of women and children dead, and the next day Al-Qaeda is going to invite in the international media and denounce the United States and everybody else for this wanton slaughter and so forth. And, you know, I'm not a paramilitary professional. I'm in no position to review which kind of plan is most likely to work or not work. But I think it's fair to say that one factor in the decision to turn it down was that there wasn't much of a sense of urgency about bin Laden at that time. He had not, to anyone's knowledge at that time, killed any Americans. And so to take a huge set of risks to capture him in an uncertain legal environment just didn't seem like the right decision to those involved.
Well, you've described one missed opportunity to capture bin Laden. Was there another missed opportunity that you discovered that is something you could describe for us?
Yeah, the next most important missed opportunity took place about 6 months after the Africa embassy bombings. And now bin Laden is clearly established as a direct threat to the United States. President Clinton has already launched one attempted cruise missile strike against him in a vain effort to kill him, and has secretly ordered the CIA to try to follow bin Laden around Afghanistan in the hopes that they can try it again. And the CIA sent on the road in southern Afghanistan a group of paid agents to track bin Laden's movements in the hope that they could spot him in a place confidently enough to warrant another cruise missile strike. And they followed bin Laden to a hunting camp in southern Afghanistan, where bin Laden had joined a group of Arab notables in some falcon hunting. And the agents reported to Washington confidently that bin Laden was there, that he was living in a tent, going out each day and hunting. The CIA sent satellites over the camp, took photography that confirmed the camp's existence, the presence of apparent Arab hunters, and a C-130 airplane that belonged to the United Arab Emirates, according to its tail numbers. And the White House then had to decide whether or not to order a cruise missile strike in the hope of killing bin Laden. And there was an intense debate about whether the evidence was strong enough.
So what decision was made?
In the end, this occurred, as I understand it, right in the midst of the impeachment burlesque. And in fact, the Senate trial was either underway or approaching. I'm not exactly certain about the time, but I know it within a few weeks. And the president decided, in part on the basis of recommendations from the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, that the evidence just wasn't strong enough. Tenet called the evidence single-threaded, meaning that the paid agents on the ground watching bin Laden from nearby were 110% certain that they had bin Laden, but they didn't have what we in journalism would call a second source, an independent source. The satellite photography wasn't good enough to confirm that it was bin Laden, and there was no other independent way to corroborate that he was there. So the president decided that he didn't have enough. He was advised that he didn't have enough to warrant the risks of a cruise missile strike.
Yeah, what were the risks? What were the consequences if they did this attack but they didn't get bin Laden?
Well, they could have been severe because they had identified this connection to the United Arab Emirates. The presence of the C-130 indicated that this hunting camp had at least sponsorship from the royal family of a very important oil-producing ally of the United States, if not perhaps even members of the royal family on the ground. So if they send in cruise missiles and killed a bunch of princes from the United Arab Emirates and did not get bin Laden, they would have generated quite a severe regional crisis. If they did get bin Laden and they killed members of the UAE royal family as well, they still would have had a problem. They might have chosen to endure it, but they just, in the end, didn't feel that the evidence was strong enough to warrant those risks.
Steve Call is the managing editor of The Washington Post. His new book is called Ghost Wars. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. And from the Sundance Channel, presenting Tanner 88, an original series from creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau. New episodes every Tuesday at 9 p.m. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Sofia Coppola. She wrote and directed Lost in Translation, which is nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. And we continue our conversation with Steve Call about the CIA's failed attempts to get bin Laden before September 11th.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Steve Call, managing editor of The Washington Post and author of the new book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10, 2001. When we left off, we were talking about why the CIA shelved a plan to launch a cruise missile attack against Bin Laden at a hunting party. Now, you mentioned that this plan, which was not followed through on, happened during the impeachment era. How do you think the impeachment proceedings affected the Clinton administration's decision-making, if at all, on the Bin Laden case?
Well, Clinton and his senior national security advisors insist to this day that it had no impact on their decision-making, that the president was able to compartmentalize his role as commander-in-chief from the crisis that he faced in his private life and in his domestic and in the impeachment sphere. I don't think any reasonable reader of this history could accept that conclusion. At the very least, you'd have to observe that the Clinton presidency was extraordinarily weakened during this period. The president was under assault from a hostile Congress. He was continually on the defensive politically. His entire presidency was at stake. And he was really not in a position, barring extraordinary acts of willpower, to take political risks during this time. And as much as he may have personally sought to compartmentalize these decisions and to isolate them and to do the right thing on foreign policy, I don't think that that you can ignore the political context in which he was operating.
You're right that when the Bush administration took over from the Clinton administration, it didn't take seriously enough the threat of Bin Laden and al-Qaeda. You say the Bush administration had other interests, such as Iraq. In what ways did they fail to take the al-Qaeda threat seriously?
Well, they were very slow to organize and to focus on it. And this was despite a series of briefings that were delivered by the outgoing Clinton National Security Team that were deliberately constructed to emphasize the importance of the al-Qaeda issue. Sandy Berger, who was Clinton's National Security Advisor in the second term, told his counterpart in the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice, that she was going to spend more time on Bin Laden than anything else. She didn't know that, but she ought to focus on it from the first day. And there were a series of briefings provided about the details, where things stood. Yet the Bush administration didn't have a meeting about Bin Laden for several months. Once they started organizing a policy debate, it unfolded really quite slowly during the spring and summer of 2001. And so by September, when the attacks occurred, that policy process was only reaching its first stages of decision-making.
Were there major intelligence failures during the Bush administration?
Well, I think major intelligence failure is a phrase that's always going to be located in the eye of the beholder. There was quite a lot of specific reporting about the Bin Laden threat during the 9 months prior to September 11th. The public record, established by the investigations carried out by the two intelligence oversight committees in Congress, establishes that the president was given quite a lot of explicit warnings about al-Qaeda plans for terrorist attacks and a number of warnings indicating that these attacks could occur inside the United States. The administration was, in fact, alert. They were concerned that these attacks were coming. But they didn't have the kind of intelligence that would allow them to predict exactly where the attacks were going to occur. In the sort of parlance of intelligence, I suppose you would say that they had strategic warning in the sense that they knew Bin Laden was out to get him and that he was actively planning to strike. But they didn't have tactical warning. They didn't know where and when. And in fact, they sort of thought that it was going to occur overseas, not in the United States.
Do you think that things like opinion polls and elections affected any of the pre-September 11th decision-making about what to do about al-Qaeda?
Well, I think that clearly there was no political context for a ground war in Afghanistan to disrupt or eliminate Al-Qaeda's headquarters and sanctuary there, the Republican Congress would never have sanctioned such a war if Clinton had proposed it. Clinton would have met almost uniform skepticism from his own party if he had proposed it. The media were banging no drums on this subject. And so there was a political context in the United States that shaped the tactics prior to September 11th and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed the tactical options to the point where those involved with trying to stop bin Laden prior to September 11th were really trying to thread a needle. After September 11th and the war against the Taliban, you saw that it was a house of cards, and it, in the end, didn't prove that formidable to destroy the camps and end the Taliban regime. But prior to September 11th, it looked terribly daunting.
George Tenet's leadership of the CIA has been questioned because of September 11th and because of the lack of weapons of mass destruction so far in Iraq. He said a few years ago, "We must now enter a new phase in our efforts against bin Laden. We are at war. I want no resources or people spirit in this effort." This was well before September 11th. You write, that never happened. How would you grade George Tenet as the head of the CIA in his decision-making about how to proceed against bin Laden?
I think he has a... I think the record is mixed. He, on the plus side, among the Clinton administration cabinet, he was unusually aware of, focused on, and alert about the bin Laden threat. He did advocate more attention, more resources, more focus on bin Laden. He knew what, he had a sense of what was coming. Despite the urgings that he provided orally, he wasn't able to deliver programmatically. And he wasn't able to rally either the president or the president's cabinet to support the kind of risk-taking covert action programs that many of his own officers felt they could successfully carry out if only they had the political support. So I think that he was strong on the warning side, but less effective on the operational side.
My guest is Steve Call, author of the new book Ghost Wars. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Call. He's managing editor of The Washington Post and author of the new book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. Where do you think, after having done all this research for this book, where do you think Iraq fits into the war on terrorism? Is it helping in the war on terrorism, or is it a distraction?
Well, if you define the war on terrorism as a war against Al-Qaeda, which is the organization that carried out the September 11th attacks, I think Iraq is, whether you think the war was just or not, it's obviously a massive distraction of resources, attention, and talent. The entire sort of Near East bureaucracy of the United States government, which are the divisions of the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department and the National Security Council that concentrate on the Arab world and South Asia, all of those resources, all of the best and brightest people in the government are all about Iraq and have been now for the last 18 months or more. And so there are just comparatively fewer resources, comparatively fewer talented people working on the bin Laden issue, the Al-Qaeda issue, whether it's in Pakistan or Afghanistan or the Caucasus or elsewhere.
There's just a little anecdote that you tell in the book that I found really interesting, and maybe it's not really important in the scheme of things, but maybe it does really say something. So I'm going to ask you about this. And this is a story you tell about William Casey, who at the time was the head of the CIA. He goes to Saudi Arabia. He's a devout Christian, and he's looking for a church to go to Mass in, to go for Mass. And would you tell this story?
It was Easter Sunday, I believe, and he was just visiting, as he did periodically. And he asked his hosts in the Saudi intelligence department to find him a chapel where he could observe Mass. And they told him what's still true in Saudi Arabia, that Christian churches are banned entirely. They are illegal. And if he attempted to construct one on the fly, he might attract the unwanted attention of the Saudi religious police. But he refused to accept this and insisted, and eventually they arranged something makeshift for him.
What is that story about to you?
Well, it's about a Saudi society that remains about as far from pluralism as Americans understand it as it's possible for a society to be.
Well, I guess what I also found interesting about the story is, Casey was a devout Christian. So was President Bush, and so were many of the people in his administration who have been close allies with the Saudis. And this is a country that doesn't tolerate their own religion. How do you make that add up?
That's a useful observation. In the Cold War era, the Saudi elite, Saudi royal family, and American decision makers like Casey, who was quite a devout Catholic, saw themselves as an alliance of believers confronting an atheistic system, communism, Soviet communism. And they took succor from their shared faith, even where they recognized that the practice of their faiths were apparently incompatible, as in the case of Casey's desire to observe Mass on Easter in Saudi Arabia. After the Cold War, after the shared threat of atheistic Bolshevism, that sense of alliance and comfort between the two elites began to unravel.
One last question. It must be very difficult to write a book on the secret history of our attempts, to get bin Laden and the secret history of the war on terrorism, because it's a secret history. You're dealing with intelligence agencies who aren't going to give it up very easily. Intelligence agencies here and in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia. How must be a really difficult book to do.
Well, you're right. And part of what I'm aware of even now, having completed it, is that as a result of the fact that the archives are simply not available, not likely to be available to anybody, scholars or journalists or anybody else, for decades, if ever, then you end up being, to some extent, a prisoner of journalism, its strengths and weaknesses, and that means you rely a lot on interviews and people's recollections. I work very hard to connect people's recollections to documents where I could find them, to timelines, to calendars, to other reliable original sources. But it's hard, and I'm aware, as any journalist, any honest journalist is, that really the history that I have is rather rooted in human recollection, which is inevitably flawed in some respects.
And you would like someday to see the real documents.
I would give anything.
Right.
Almost anything.
Steve Call, thank you so much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Steve Call is the managing editor of the Washington Post. His new book is called Ghost Wars. The movie Lost in Translation is nominated for 4 Academy Awards: Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Actor. My guest, Sofia Coppola, wrote and directed the film. Her father, Francis Ford Coppola, is an executive producer of the film. This is her second movie. Her first was an adaptation of the novel The Virgin Suicides. Lost in Translation is about two people who might not have had much in common if they'd met at a dinner in America, but they meet in Japan, where they're feeling lost, lonely, and alienated, which creates a strong bond between them. Bill Murray plays a washed-up American actor who's filming a liquor commercial in Tokyo. Scarlett Johansson is in Tokyo with her husband, a photographer on assignment. She's in her 20s and is having an identity crisis. Bill Murray is having a midlife crisis. In this scene, they're in his hotel room, lying on the bed talking.
I'm stuck. Does it get easier?
No. Yes. It gets easier.
Oh, yeah? Look at you.
Thanks. And the more you know who you are and what you want, the less you let things upset you.
Yeah. I just don't know what I'm supposed to be. You know? I tried being a writer, but I hate what I write. And I tried taking pictures, but they're so mediocre, you know? And every girl goes through a photography phase. You know, like horses. You know, take dumb pictures of your feet.
You'll figure that out. And I'm not worried about you. Keep riding.
But I'm so mean.
Mean's okay.
Yeah. What about marriage? Does that get easier?
That's hard.
Sofia Coppola studied painting and art history. I asked her about the film's opening image. Lost in Translation starts with a shot of Scarlett Johansson lying on the bed in her hotel room, and we see her behind and her back. It's a back shot of her torso. She's in her underwear and a long-sleeved T-shirt. And the pose itself is a kind of classic pose of feminine beauty that you might find. It's a pose you've seen in a lot of paintings. But although Scarlett Johansson is really quite beautiful, this pose seems to be, in your movie, more about being alone and only half-dressed in bed with no place to go than it is about evoking any, like, real strong sexuality. It's a very unselfconscious pose. And I'm just wondering what your intention was in starting with this shot.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted it just to be a glimpse of femininity, you know, that it's this, you know, it's girl's butt in pink underwear and that it's, you know, has an innocence, but also because the story starts with the character of Bill Murray, I just wanted a hint of this girl kind of hanging around a hotel room before, and she's always kind of in a T-shirt or underwear, as you are in hotel rooms. And but I always liked the Stanley Kubrick's Lolita is one of my favorite movies, and the opening of that is just a close up of her feet, and just this sort of, you know, icon of femininity that's not really a scene from the movie, that's its own thing. So that was what I was thinking about. And then my brother had a book of John Cassera, the painter who I think spent his whole career painting girls' butts and underwear, and that's kind of that was sort of the reference for that.
I want to play another short scene from Lost in Translation, and in this scene, a prostitute has been sent up to Bill Murray's room by I think if I remember correctly from by somebody who's shooting the commercial with him, mm-hmm. And so this is a big surprise to Bill Murray. She comes up, she's Japanese, her English isn't very good, and he doesn't even know what she's saying to him. So let me play that scene.
Okay. Mr. Harris?
Yes?
Mr. Kazuo sent me.
Oh?
May I enter? Thank you. Direct massage?
I don't think I like massage anymore.
Mr. Kazuo sent premium fantasy. My stockings. Lip then. Lip. My stockings. Yes, please. Lip them.
What?
Lip them. Hey, lip my stocking.
Hey, lip hey. Them. Lip them. Lip. What?
Lip them like this. Lip them.
Rip them?
Lip, yes.
You want me to rip your stockings?
Yes, rip my stockings, please.
Rip your stockings?
Yes,
you want
please,
me to rip your stockings?
Please,
so.
Please.
A short scene from Lost in Translation with Bill Murray. My guest is the film's writer and director, Sofia Coppola. Sofia Coppola, where did that scene come from? Was that based on an actual experience somebody you know had?
A friend of mine told me a story that happened to him that was similar to that. It wasn't really a prostitute, but with a misunderstanding like that, which I thought was funny. And I remember talking to our AD, who was Japanese, about the R and L switch, because that scene, you know, hinges on that. And I said, you know, is this offensive at all? And he said, no, we really do that. And he was laughing, you know. So it's just one of the, you know, those things with the language and the translation that that happens.
And it's interesting. You said you asked the assistant director if he thought that that was offensive, because, you know, a few reviewers have said that they thought, you know, that the flaw they found with your movies, they thought it was a little condescending toward the Japanese because of scenes like that. What would you say to that?
You know, I just put, you know, I wanted to have the experience of what it's like being a foreigner there, and I don't think my movie's condescending at all. I mean, I have great love and respect for the country and the culture, and, you know, that we're having a sense of humor about the differences, but, you know, we make fun of the American sellout movie star who's there making a buck.
And all that stuff is real.
I mean, working with the Japanese crew and everything, you know, it's all based on real differences.
My guest is Sofia Coppola. She wrote and directed the film Lost in Translation, which is nominated for 4 Academy Awards. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sofia Coppola. She wrote and directed the film Lost in Translation, which is nominated for 4 Academy Awards. When you're writing a screenplay, particularly a screenplay like Lost in Translation, where there's so much happening that's purely visual, do you see the scenes as you're writing them? Are you composing the images even as you're writing the words?
Yeah, definitely. When I'm writing the script, it's really just reminders and notes of what I'm picturing. So I'm definitely, you know, thinking about the imagery and then trying to write that down as best I can to remember how I want to shoot it.
And what about the scenes between Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson? Were any of those scenes improvised?
Those scenes were more scripted. The meeting and the scene where they talk all night, that was really more that was scripted.
There's a scene at a karaoke bar in which Scarlett Johansson sings a song. Bill Murray sings 2 songs. He sings What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. And he also sings Roxy Music's More Than This. Who chose the songs for him to sing?
More Than This, the Roxy Music song, came about just last minute when we were on the set. Bill and I had been talking before about how we both love that album, Avalon. And we were shooting in a real karaoke place, and I just looked up on their menu, and they had that song, More Than This, and I said, oh, you know, will you sing this for me? And we were just in another little booth, just the two of us, and he sang it, and he was so sincere and heartfelt, and I thought, oh, we have to put this in the movie. So luckily we got permission afterwards to use the song, but just the lyrics and everything. I love watching that moment, because you really feel like that's the moment where she really... the way she looks at him, and, you know, it's really that kind of crush moment, and the lyrics are kind of fitting.
Well, Sofia Coppola, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing fallen leaves in the night. Who can say where they're blowing? As free as the wind, hopefully learning why the sea on the tide has no way of turning. More than this, you know there's nothing. More than this, tell me one thing. More than this, ooh, there's nothing.
Bill Murray from the soundtrack of Lost in Translation. Sofia Coppola wrote and directed the film. It's nominated for 4 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Actor. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Audrey Bentham is our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Frank Sinatra singing Fly Me to the Moon. It was written by Bart Howard. Howard died on Saturday at the age of 88.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Song, let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Richard Engel was the only American TV correspondent who reported from Baghdad before, during, and after the war. He reported live on the bombing for ABC. On the next Fresh Air, Engel tells us how he stayed on the air and how he stayed alive. His new memoir is called A Fist in the Hornet's Nest. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.